So the trick is to find out where we stopped. I'm thinking we stopped with verse 6. Does that make sense?
Did we ever have a really good discussion about one and two and why the
You know, I don't think
segregation?
so. Maybe we should just start at one and yeah, that's good.
Don't recall anything about that.
I read something about the poll. I don't think that we have to read it again. I think we've read it twice already,
Yeah.
that section. The poll is was I actually a reed, a very strong reed that was hollow in the center. And it was very long. And so they used it as a measuring rod. That's what I read, I think, in Stefanovic, his commentary.
I thought it was interesting that they talk about measuring the temple, which, okay, I can see how you would measure that, the altar. I see how you can measure that. And then, count those who are worshiping there. So it's interesting that there's a mix of temple, altar, and worshipers.
Yeah, and I'm not sure this was Jonathan's translation that said count.
That mine says count, but I've read other translations where it
Yes.
continues to say measure.
Yeah.
Also, so he says count, but I've read other, yes.
Yeah, I don't know that count is the best. I should get my Greek New Testament.
Would it mean to measure the participants as opposed to counting them?
Yes.
Evaluating.
It would be to measure maybe their faith.
Or that infamous story from Story Hour about the measuring rod.
Oh, I never listened to it on Story Hour, but I had to read it as a child.
I missed that one. Yay.
Yes, that's right. Yay.
Oh, it was
So
very troubling.
the meaning of measuring the altar and measuring the worshipers are different.
Well,
It's pretty up for question, isn't it?
yeah, but the problem is you're dealing with inanimate things and you're dealing with animate things.
Right.
And so things are going to be different, it would seem to me.
Unless, if everything here is obviously symbolic, but sometimes it's not so obvious when you get into discussions like this,
Yeah.
because the temple is the people. Right.
And Jennings does this with it. Go and examine God's temple. Count the number of living stones. Examine the altar of their hearts. Kind of interesting.
11, verse 1. He said, go. Okay. Meteson.
The word for measure.
I think meteson is the word for measure. It looks like it. I have the most humongous Greek dictionary. I can't hold it on my lap. I have to stand up and now I forget how it's spelled. Let me grab this. Okay, epsilon.
So, for those who have studied this before, is there supposed to be any connection to what we have identified as Jesus at the very end of chapter 10, saying you must prophesy again regarding many peoples, nations, languages, and kings? Is there any connection to this measuring process to what they were just told, or we just separate those completely?
There's a connection between 11 and 10, but whether there's a connection between that specific verse and 11 and 10, I don't know.
Well, I certainly think it would be useful to assume there's a connection and look for one. I think everything is strategically located in Revelation for a reason.
But the content does change. I mean,
Right.
if you go through it, it bounces back and forth, and so there's not a lot of continuity, linear discussion or presentation.
If he's told that he must prophesy again, and then he's immediately handed a reed to go measure, could that be part of what he's being commissioned to do? Is it part of, is it a continuing instruction? So it's like, you need to prophesy again. Here's a reed. Here's the first thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
What if it is a direct continuation of that instruction?
Now, this is very interesting. I get into Matthew, but the only thing I find that comes even close to Matthew-son is Matthew-sesthai. And it says, it's from the verb matethemi. Okay. So I have to look up matethemi. Sorry to take so long. But that's the joys of Greek sometimes.
Well, the temple is where God's supposed to dwell, right? So, and the altar, do you think they're referring to where his Shekinah glory is, that altar?
That's not usually considered an altar. That would be the Ark.
Ark of the Covenant. So this would be what altar would this be? Altar of incense?
I think it would be safer to say it's the altar of sacrifice, because the temple would be on the left side, the courtyard, the right side of the courtyard, depending which way you're looking at it, left side. Anyway, the temple is the primary collection of things on one side, and the altar is almost the only main focal point on the other side. So they're directly across from each other.
And that would be out in the courtyard area then, correct?
Right. But then he qualifies everything here, and he says, leave out
court outside the temple.
The court, which is outside of the temple, and don't measure the court. A lot of symbolism here that's, I think, extremely significant.
Could this be related to like a beginning of an investigative judgment? So that he wants to leave out the people outside, but we need to take a look at the people that are inside.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does have some inference in that direction.
Okay, I got lost in that book. Print is fine. And the word that I was led to in that dictionary did not mean anything close to the meaning it's given by translation. So I'm going to get a reader's lexicon, which will probably give me a better clue.
Well, I wrote down in my notes on that word measure.
Oh, it's metreo, measure. What would you get? Metrics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes much more sense.
Mm-hmm.
I went a long journey away from reality.
In our parlance, we might say gather data on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there's a statement by Ellen White that I want to insert here because I know how troubling this topic can be. She said that we are not to regard God as, I can't remember how she words it, but it's something to the effect that it's not like we have pictured the investigative judgment with God, handing down sentences and trying to find all our faults and, find ways to keep us out of heaven, like the way it was pictured to us as we were growing up. She says that this is a positive judgment, that God is trying to save everybody in his church and as much as he can. And that this is a positive judgment, not a negative one. That this is, I think it goes back to the ceiling. To find, to find who's been sealed, who's so settled into the truth they can't be moved.
That's a really good connection.
And it would make sense given 11 and what we're moving into in chapter 12, which really opens up the great controversy.
Right.
You know, that would make sense that something needs to happen, transition to, you know, get us ready.
So you pushed a button, Nancy. Are you done? I'm sorry. I think I broke it. Okay.
Yeah.
You pushed a button. And up came a whole bunch of files. I don't know if you remember Graham saying that. But what comes to my mind is that one of the greatest disasters in the Adventist Church that we've done is to separate the investigative judgment from the Great Controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Great Controversy, you have very clearly Joshua the high priest in Zechariah 3, and Satan at his right hand to accuse him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And here's Yahweh, the angel of Yahweh, standing there and defending him. Mm-hmm. That is the nature of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we have an enemy who is the accuser of the brethren, to go into Revelation 12.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is defending us against his charges to the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we've left that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But this isn't, I believe that statement's in Christ's Object Lessons, and I believe it is that she uses Joshua the high priest and the angel of the Lord.
That's much more comforting.
Yeah.
In that case, my understanding of the investigative judgment is that this is more about taking a look or a review of how God has handled the great controversy and the charges against him, and in particular, using evidence from the lives of various people who have followed him or not. So
look at Job.
An entirely different spin on it. It might be about us, but it's really about God.
Mm-hmm.
Which nobody wants to believe that the hour of his judgment has come is really about God, but I still don't understand why it can't be.
I think it clearly is.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
why would a sovereign God allow himself to be judged?
I think the judgment about us is a defense judgment. Defending us. That's how she paints it there in Christ's Object Lessons, as I recall. And so I want to go back to the big picture, if you don't mind, because I won't remember this when we go through the big picture part. There are actually four investigative type judgments. There's first the judgment of God, who's on trial before the universe, and his judgment that is culminated at the cross, where he wins his case. And in Romans 3:4, it's, may you win your case when you take it into court. The Good Speed translation.
Mm-hmm.
When you are brought into judgment.
Yeah.
Good Speed, when you take it into court, is the equivalent of when you're brought into judgment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the reason why Graham liked take it into court is because who can drag God into court?
Well, Job wanted to.
You know, and that's true. And I think that changed for him before the end of his life. But I never heard it clearly enough to know for sure. So the first judgment is on the character of God. The second judgment is whether his character holds, whether you can really love. If the law is the law of love, can anybody really keep it? Can anybody really love?
So that would be a judgment of his law.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But his character as well, because he is love.
Well, that is his character.
Yeah.
In other words, his claim to love unconditionally has been challenged vociferously.
And I think it includes his claim, his ability to help us to love.
Right.
To love us effectively. And so what, that's the second judgment. And maybe we should call it phases rather than judgments.
Well, if we use Jesus' definition of judgment, it totally changes it.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, imposing a sentence on somebody. Judgment is about turning on the light to see what's really there.
Exactly, exactly.
So you're referencing John 3.
Yeah.
Right.
7, 12,
and also John 12. Yeah. Because when John gives the summary of Jesus' teachings, that key element is there.
Mm-hmm.
So to John, it was very important. So then the third judgment. And so the first two judgments, well, I'm sorry. There's one I missed out. Okay, the first and third judgment. The third judgment is the one that involves God's people. But if the second judgment is the judgment of the little horn in Daniel 7. And that judgment portrays is a negative judgment because the little horn collapses. It comes to its end. And that is the early to late Christian church. And finally, the final one is what happens at the end of the millennium. And to me, that is still the same kind of thing.
Except
that the truth shows that they don't like the light.
Mm.
They wouldn't come to it.
I think the final judgment is a composite of all the other judgments that completely come to a full head all at the same time. So God is on judge on the day of judgment. His enemy is on judge, being, you know, God is exposed for who he really is.
Yeah, because
the enemy is exposed for who he really is. The people that God says, I could change them if they'll let me. You got both sides, the ones who wouldn't let him and the ones who did let him. And they're all exposed.
Right. I think that what we have is God having everybody tell their stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because isn't that what he does when they come up against the city? He tells his story.
Yeah.
He actually shows it. He brings it up on light rays and they actually see it happen.
Let me just show you it in real time instead of trying to regurgitate it. Let me just let you see it.
Yeah.
So is that to benefit not only the angels, the non-looking universe, but those who are saved?
It's to benefit everybody, even those who are lost.
Yeah. I think that's the insurance policy that guarantees it'll never happen again.
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that why everyone says God is just?
Right.
Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that God was just. Because
and that's the sentence. I mean, that's the verdict.
That's the verdict.
Yeah.
Yeah. God is just. Even if I'm lost, I still say that because I see God doing everything he absolutely could. If I'm saved and people that I love are lost, I'll say God is just because you see it's all on display. Right.
And that's what Paul talks about when God justifies sinners, then he has to be justified for doing that.
Exactly. May you be shown to be upright when you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 1 John 1:9, you know,
and that's taken
God
from Psalms.
Forgives those who confess. He has to be proven just.
Right. That's
in
taken
forgiving
from Psalms.
And cleansing.
Psalm 32, I think it is, where David is pleading for forgiveness.
To me, that's the active element in this idea that nobody is lost by accident, meaning that everybody has full understanding of the real issues and is not making their choice from lack of information or anything else, which I think means healing from mental or physical diseases that might make it impossible to choose. I think God has to restore them to their full faculties, give them the full information, and say, is this what you want?
Yeah. I'm not sure that they fully understand, because the wicked don't say just and loving are your ways. Just and true.
They acknowledge that they have lied about him, and that what he has said is true, and that what Jesus said is true. But acknowledging that somebody is right and they won their case doesn't mean you're still not angry and bitter at them.
Right. The devils believe, but they tremble. They fear God. And that's one of the, seems to be the contrasting, you know, they fear the wrath of the Lamb. So there's a part of them that says you're right, but there's still that non-acceptance of, I don't need to be afraid of God. They're fearful.
So I think of the panorama that they have seen. They have seen everything, including Jesus at the cross.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing clearer that God loves them than that.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they say that he's just and loving?
They don't believe in love.
They don't like it. They abhor it.
Does that imply that they like the fact that what he said was true?
Admission is not the same as liking something. It's just that when you've run out of evidence to support your lies, you have to admit you don't have any evidence left. It doesn't mean you changed your mind. It just means
I guess I'm pushing back about a little bit on Jean's statement that she's not sure if they understand completely, because if they did, they would say he was loving. I tend to more agree that, yeah, they don't even think that's the issue. So as far as God can get them without giving them new hearts and right spirits is that they, as far as he can get them, is to say, yeah, you're right. I don't like it. I don't want to be that way. But yes, you're right.
So it's as far as the love of God, maybe just it went on by, because to them it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And they still may insist that selfless love doesn't exist. So all they're going to say is, you're just and you're truthful, but we still don't believe love.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you're right, Floyd. I think if your concept of love is God and your God is a monster, well, who wants that? Who wants love?
I just thought, you know, Revelation 22, that kind of sums stuff up. It says, whoever doesn't do what is right, let them stay that way. Whoever is impure, let them stay that way. Whoever does what is right, let them stay that way. Whoever is holy, let them stay that way. So part of the judgment is just the diagnosis of, you want to stay the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
And God releases us to experience the consequences of whatever state we have chosen, even though he would offer us a different state. So he lets us experience. Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. Those words come to mind.
Yeah.
It really does speak to his God's emphasis on our freedom to choose, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God's wrath is like giving us what we want, what mm-hmm. we've chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that statement is really his wrath saying, I'm giving you what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So these two verses are suggesting that there is a separation, a natural separation that has already happened. And mm-hmm. John is told, you must prophesy, which is to speak on behalf of God.
Mm-hmm.
As you're speaking on behalf of God, you're going to need some standard of measure. And your assignment is go investigate and measure the ones who have professed to worship in the temple at the altar, but don't bother measuring the ones who have already been given over on the outside, because it's already clear that they have rejected the temple the altar to worship there. So don't bother. You know, the separation's mm-hmm. already begun here, but he's saying, he's being told, you need to go investigate this, measure it, bring it to light.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what the word handed over is there? You know, is that anywhere I give you up and I let you go that you just mentioned?
Given over to, given, has been given to the nations and they will trample the holy city, that one?
Yeah, that handed over, is that, you know?
It could be just given. Let me
hand it over.
Is it the same as give up?
Let's see. Verse 2.
It's didamai.
Is it didamai?
Mm-hmm. It's not paradidamai, but it's didamai.
I'm scanning this, and I don't see didamai or didami.
Yeah, it's there.
And what does that mean?
It is given.
Give up.
Didamai.
It's the same one as you find in Romans. It's the same one as you find in the Septuagint.
That's paradidamai.
It is? What?
Yeah. In Romans, it's paradidami.
Oh, and that's right. Paradidami. Didomai is simply to give.
Yeah. Mm. So paradidami would be more like to release.
Hand over.
To hand over.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
to
what
give
is it?
Up.
We hand over and give.
And to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's paradidami.
So the para, what does para mean? Parallel?
Parallel means alongside of.
Alongside. So
with.
So paradidami means that God agrees with your decision.
Now, you want to go that way? I'm sad.
This one is short of that. It doesn't have the para included.
No, it's just to give, like you would give a gift.
Okay.
Or to simply give.
But the fact that they're Gentiles, which is not literal here, it's spiritual. The fact that they're Gentiles means they have identified as outsiders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. he's like, okay, give it to them, and they will tread it underfoot for 42 months. And to me, that's like a fake Christianity, which does resonate strongly with, you know, with the 42-month prior, is it 1,260 years?
Mm-hmm.
Of the Dark Ages, it's a fake. Mm-hmm. It's a pagan Christianity.
That's the Christianity that believes in a God who is a angry, vengeful, and severe, and very judgmental.
And he said, and so he's instructed, don't measure that Christianity.
Yeah. No.
That makes sense.
I think that parallels Ellen White's statement that some, even in the temple, with God's temple, some names are brought forward and some names are not accepted.
Mm.
But because this judgment is a defense judgment only for those who can be defended.
Mm.
I'm looking to see how this morphs into the two witnesses. Because I'm looking for patterns of connections here, and it seems to start coming clear because they're called my two witnesses. It's almost like John is given a temporary role as a judge himself, or at least as an investigator. And it says, you know, go measure the temple and those who worship and the altar, that whole system. Don't measure the counterfeit system that's handed over for 42 months. Don't even bother. It's already clearly not mine. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I've got two witnesses.
So if you put this in a court setting.
Well, that's what it sounds like, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you put it in a court setting, he's given measurements. I'm trying to think how an ancient court would measure anything. This is a bit of different term than you would normally use for any court case.
Yeah.
I did something strange here on a whim. I don't know if any of you have heard of ChatGPT, but I put in a question And it came up with something interesting. It referred back to the Old Testament examples of measuring. And it says that this has to do with God taking ownership of the temple. Is there anything to that?
It could. The verb to go to and fro and go up and down upon it, those two verbs.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham is told by God to go up and down upon the land. And it's sort of like he's staking out his claim, and that would be a form of measurement.
And if that's his people, that's even more interesting, because this would be talking about God taking ownership of his people.
So would the two witnesses represent people who worship at the temple and the altar?
The two witnesses.
The law and the prophets.
These two witnesses are the two olive trees.
Yeah.
And the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. They're the light.
This is a court case, and there's ownership disputes, and witnesses would be something that would bear witness to the fact that God owns this or has done the right thing.
They're witnesses to the truth by which we are judged.
Mm-hmm. Corroborating testimony.
Yeah, and in that case, measurement is God staking out his claim, like he does in the book of Job. Have you not considered my servant Job? And in fact, at the end of the book, what's really revealing is when he talks to Eliphaz and reprimands him for not speaking of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Mm-hmm. It tells him to do his sacrifice. He casts my servant Job into his teeth four times.
Say that again. I didn't follow. He what?
He casts the term my servant Job. He uses it four times.
Okay.
It's like he casts it in his teeth. Like, there, take that. He's my servant Job. Got it?
Mm-hmm.
Because in a sense, the witnesses turned accuser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They definitely did. I wrote down here for the word measure, to ascertain in size by a fixed measure, which is what the literal definition was, meaning to ascertain the size of worth, value, or true character, which really is about judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, judging is to discern what is true.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, the witnesses help because they're shedding light, right? I mean, this is all about all of the source of light, the illumination of light.
If you believe that these symbols can change from generation to generation as new situations arise, if Elijah and Moses are these two witnesses,
mm-hmm.
they would be Torah and the prophets in the Jewish way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe that in the Christian era, especially this fits the liturgy of the temple. Okay, since we're talking about the temple,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about the liturgy. The service was made up of a reading from Torah without comment in the Jewish temple exercises. And it was read from if you're facing the front of the temple, it's read from the left, Torah. That is followed probably by singing psalms by the Levites. That is followed probably by a reading from the prophets, Elijah, to the right, followed by a commentary. Now you find the example of this in Luke 4, I think it is, where Jesus is in Nazareth and they hand him the scroll of Isaiah and ask him to read it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the prophet the prophetic reading. He's going to stand up at the right side, and he's going to, and instead of reading where they left off, which I think they intended him to do, he starts unrolling the scroll where he wants to go. And he gets to Isaiah 61, the Lord has anointed me, and so on. And then he sits down.
And he also stops short of their highly anticipated
vengeance. Yes. He sits down without comment. And all the eyes of the congregation are on him, like, okay, city boy, we had you once. When are you going to give the commentary?
You know the routine. What's going on here?
He turns around and he says, this day has this passage been fulfilled in your ears?
Yes.
And then he gives them a rebuke. And they take him out and try to throw him off a cliff.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen that in The Chosen?
No, I haven't.
You should watch it. You would really like it. They did a really good job of portraying that.
Because one of the scribes there says, but you left out. And they specifically identify what he left out in the reading. And then he comments on that. Remember, Floyd?
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
oh, wow.
They well researched that stuff, I'll tell you. And he sat down and then he begins commenting. And, you know, at first everybody's excited and everything. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, are you implying? What? You know, it's like, you can't do that.
Yep.
Yeah, they did a good job.
You're not the kind of God we're looking for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that what they say?
I mean, it would have happened there if Jesus didn't walk through the crowd. That
I was going to say, if the Chosen had that, and that'd be really glorious.
They just had him simply walk through the crowd. Special effects. He just... Nope. And I thought, okay, that's
what the scripture says. He just walked through.
He says a powerful phrase.
Right.
That's not going to happen today.
Yeah. I never imagined it that way. You know, I wondered how they were going to handle that. And I thought, you know, are they going to have him just walk through the mob of angry people or whatever? But he literally speaks with authority, and they're just standing there like almost paralyzed emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he just says, that's not going to happen today. And he just walks right past them. And it's not like they're physically handicapped. It's just that what he says is so authoritative that it completely changes the whole atmosphere. And that was amazing.
Yeah, but it's the authority of truth and not the authority of anger.
And he wasn't resisting. You know, it was well done. I was really surprised at how they did it.
It was impressive. I agree.
Yeah.
Go see or tune in.
But see season 1 and 2 first, otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You have to see season 1, 2, 3 for 3 to make sense, I think. But
yeah,
that's my little The Chosen ad.
Well, I want to look at it when it's all done and I see if the shoe fell off the foot.
You've only got 24 episodes to catch up on.
I know, but you know, I need to get something done.
Oh, I got you.
I just, there's things I can't do right now.
I understand.
I just think it's cool. I keep praying for The Chosen because they are reaching a whole ton of people.
Oh, they are, I'm sure.
These people in multiple countries. So I go, God is on the move.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is done.
Wouldn't it be cool if we could get them the larger view, at least a piece of it? Cosmic controversy view.
I see hints of that already.
I was going to say, I'm not sure they don't have it.
They've read Desire of Ages. Didn't I hear that they had that?
Somebody said that they saw a video in the writer's room, you know, where all the writers were gathered. And somebody said they saw Desire of Ages laying on the table.
See, if they did, they do have a cosmic conflict.
Yeah.
If they read it, because they would read it without all the baggage that we carry into that book.
Well, you know, we think we're the only people who has a controversy, a great controversy perspective. John Eldridge, I can cite multiple Christians who are influential authors.
Greg Boyd.
They know the battle is over your heart. They know it's a spiritual battle. They know it's not about who's got the power. They know a God is a God.
It's in here.
And Greg Boyd openly talks about the character of God.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I had the privilege of talking with him over food one time, and all of a sudden in the middle of our conversation, he says, "You know, Jean, we think an awful lot alike." I can tell he was a little perplexed about how that could be, but, you know, the same spirit is leading us. That's what I think.
As with God in Israel, he's talking to anybody who will listen in whatever language they can hear. So it would be astounding if we were the only one.
They were so jealous of anybody else coming on board.
Right.
So
I think this also ties in these first two verses. This polarization and the sequence here is 1 Peter 4:17. The time has come for judgment to begin with the household of God. If it begins first with us, what will happen to those who don't obey the good news of God? That's what I summarizing these two verses here.
I think just one other thought that comes to mind is, you know, how when things are handed over, you know, there's this reference, as we've said, to the 42 months where a distorted view of God ruled the world and people were murdered to, quote, save them. And this, you know, imprisonment and persecution, and you just see all the characteristics of Satan. And that was, quote, Christianity, where Christians were completely comfortable with murdering people, stealing, torturing, you know, the whole awful, so many of the awful things that occurred during that period of time, and suppression of anything of truth. You just go, wow, what happens when that view of God rules?
Yeah. You just answered my question I was about to raise. I was going to point out that these two witnesses can highlight punishment and plagues and all of that. The fire coming down from heaven, the water turning into blood. Why is that highlighted as the witnesses instead of something about Jesus or some, you know, because imagine people who were burning people at the stake being told that God's glory was going to consume them. It's a warning to them, speaking their own language and meeting them where they are.
That makes a lot more sense. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You were the one that helped me see that.
He was on what I was saying. So, because I always thought it's interesting, they have this power, but they don't use it against these people that end up killing them. So,
But they have the witnesses there that meet them where they are.
Yeah. That was also that they allowed themselves to be killed, just as Jesus had the power to totally destroy. He didn't use it because that would not speak well of God.
Right. There was something I wanted to say about the Inquisition. You know, in the SDA Bible commentary series, the old one, in the source, I think it's a source book, no, SDA Bible dictionary, there's actually a quotation that says that the priests, when someone was being burned to the stake because they were heretic, the priest would hold out the cross and say, if you accept this, you will not burn forever and ever in hell. You will only spend your time in purgatory. And they burn people at the stake to give them a taste of what would happen when they burn forever and ever in hell. And they did it in, quote, love. I have to tell you a personal story. I took a class on history of art, Renaissance to modern, at Andrews University. It was summer school. And the professor decided to take us on a field trip to the Chicago Museum of Art. And it was really fun because you could go through every room, and if you went in the sequence from the earliest Madonnas to later art forms, you got a real taste of the history of art. Almost every room was fairly good size, had lots of paintings on the wall. And he led us to this one little room. It was very small. It was probably 6 by 7 or something like that. It's very small. And there were only a few paintings in there. And he said, this is the classical period. Remember, in the classical period, the artists believed that everything had to be in rote form. You had to have everything be perfect. Everything, there be no blemishes, nothing. So when they painted George Washington, they painted him without his mole on his mouth or cheek or whatever it was. And so on. And he said, consequently, there weren't very many painters or paintings, because it just snuffed out the creativity spirit that anybody had, all the artists had. So they just dried up. Well, we walked into that room, and the most prominent painting, the largest one, was called The Grand Inquisitor. And I looked at that painting, and I could see this look in his face. Initially, you felt like he was saying, I love you, kind of saccharinely. And then if you look deeper in his eyes, and if you don't love me, I'll kill you. And I chilled. It was a hot summer day. But I chilled, thinking, this is the picture of God that millions had during that time. I love you, but I'll kill you if you don't obey me. And I have heard it said that God will lovingly destroy the wicked from an Adventist.
Yeah. I was taught that. It's an act of love to burn them to death. And you are not to question that.
And to make sure they last as long as possible in the fire. No.
No, that they burn according to the calculations figured out by the saved during the millennium.
Right.
So it was.
Is it only Adventists that struggle with this baggage from redefining love to be something other than
it's crazy
what it really is?
Insanity. No.
It's mostly redefining it to mean what it actually is.
I think I was young enough, because I was 14 when I got the love of God. I think I didn't have as much of trouble with redefining love. But as I grew in my understanding, I could see how the people who loved me the most didn't know how to love me fully. And that was kind of disconcerting. As they grew, they began to know how to love. Now, I see a false picture of God as the greatest abuser of all humankind.
Mm-hmm. But the picture of hell is definitely that.
Yeah. And it led Ellen White to say in The Great Controversy, when she's depicting it, that cruelty is satanic. God is love.
Mm-hmm. I see the
picture verse. And I see that satanic look on his face. And you're talking about the one that's depicting the Grand Inquisitor from Dostoevsky's. Yeah, my first thought was that's a demonic, that's a demon in the background.
Yes. Yes.
And
you have to look closely to see it, but
yeah. That whole chapter, I mean, he has that Grand Inquisitor talking to Jesus for like 40 pages. It's a fascinating. Dostoevsky did a great job with that.
I see verse 2 and 3 with a link to tie together the first module, which is the first two verses, with the next module, which is the two witnesses. And the connecting link is 42 months and then 1,260 days, which is the same length.
Mm.
So it's saying, okay, it's given over to the nations. They're going to tread the holy city underfoot for this length of time. Now, there's two witnesses, same time period. Mm-hmm. So it's saying we're talking about the same time period, but here's a different aspect that I want to talk about here now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why months in the first one and days in the second one? I think there's probably something to that too, but
maybe to distinguish between them.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, my mom had this saying, something like, if you, I don't remember exactly what it was now, but it was sort of funny because it was like, if you do this, your cold is only going to last 14 days. But if you don't do that, it's going to last for 2 weeks.
That was a joke.
I know. But there's something psychological to it.
Yeah. 14 days is longer than 2 weeks.
Well, no, 2 weeks sounds longer.
Mm.
It's whole weeks. I mean, good grief. Days are short. Weeks are long. Months are long. Days are short. So the same kind of mind trick might be applying here is, okay, they're going to tread the holy city underfoot for a long time. It's 42 months. My witnesses are going to prophesy 1,260 days. And the very word days is like, oh, well, that's not as long. Wait, it's the same once you mathematically calculate it. Or is it saying they're going to prophesy every single day for 1,260 days?
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I also have a question that says the two olive trees, the two lampstands, and I understand that's coming from Zechariah.
Mm-hmm.
But it says standing before the Lord of the earth. Could that potentially be a different Lord? Because in Revelation, all those who dwell on the earth is a code phrase for everyone who rejects God's mercy. Could the Lord of the earth represent the Lord of all those who dwell on the earth? Okay. I know it messes with our tradition, but I have to ask questions.
Well, I think it's an important question.
And then the very next verse, anybody desires to harm them, fire proceeds out of their mouth, devours the enemies. If anybody desires to harm them, he must be killed in this way. That sounds like the Lord of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like Satan's tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Is that representative of the fallen pagan Christianity depending on the Old Testament dark views of God and condensing those dark views down under the name of Christ and applying them for that length of time? So it's all about plagues. It's all about torturing people with fire, killing them with fire, constantly fear-based religion, control, mind control. I don't know what all of this resonates an awful lot with the dark views during the dark ages.
The only problem I have is
they're resurrected.
He's being told, not just that. He's being told, I will allow my two witnesses, the I there is
right.
So whoever is speaking for God.
But he gave power to the witnesses in the Old Testament, and they misrepresented him too.
But that's why I said earlier that I think that this is God's last ditch stand.
Yeah.
To speak to the people where they are, to meet them.
I like where you guys are going. I'm wondering, is there any significance between 42 months, which is 3.5 years, which is exactly the length of Jesus' ministry?
And why is there dead bodies for 3.5 days? Isn't that the same as 1260?
Yeah. But the literal significance of that I don't think can be missed, because they are crucified with Jesus. That's how I would read it.
Yeah, this is a challenging prophecy. Yeah. And again, I'm always open to multiple ways of looking at it, and even ending with multiple ways of looking at it. You know, I don't feel compelled that we have to come up with a single final answer.
Mm-hmm.
Would the 3.5 days have anything to do with the symbolism of Lazarus, where he had to be dead for 4 days before they believed he was really dead?
Hmm. That's interesting.
Or Christ in the tomb.
Now, here's another crazy outside idea. If they are dead, and if this is representative of the Torah and the prophets, and then we said 3.5 days represents 3.5 years of Jesus' ministry, is there some kind of spiritual demise of the law and the prophets while Jesus is ministering for 3.5 years? There's a battle going on between his version of God and the Old Testament version of God for 3.5 years, except they aren't celebrating. they're duking it out with him.
Exactly. They're trying to trample down his entire work, mm-hmm. or Satan is.
His perspective on God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why they killed him. He said, I'm God. And they said, no, you're not. Because their understanding of the law and the prophets did not fit this kind of God. It was right. I mean, they knew the law and the prophets very well, but they planned Jesus's murder because they said, this is not the God we worship.
We don't know much about Jesus' life other than his ministry. And that's right. When he seems to be the least popular,
mm-hmm.
you know, amongst the religious leaders, whatever.
Of course, what this says, this is not saying that the religious leaders in Jerusalem are celebrating. This is saying the peoples, tribes, languages, and nations, which are previously identified as the Gentiles, left out of the temple.
Right.
It's them that are celebrating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For 3.5 days. I'm sure this applies multiple times throughout history. So that's part of why there could be apparent discrepancies here and there. It's like a single prophecy that has multi-use will have elements in it that some elements are going to fit one event much better than another.
Yeah, but I think central to this is the crucifixion. And I see that same thing in the plagues, the seven plagues in Revelation 16 or 18. No, wait a minute. Revelation 16.
16. So are you saying the plagues would be the 3.5 days?
No, they're echoes of the events of Jesus' death.
Right. But how would that tie in here?
3.5 days at that point.
So that would be just before the 3.5 days then.
You know, I don't think that the plagues are interest. I mean, that John was interested in time with the plagues. I just see a pattern here. This is one of two times where the crucifixion of Jesus plays a major role in events. So obviously.
But here it's more about the location than it is the time, isn't it? Because it identifies Sodom and Egypt,
mm-hmm.
where their Lord was also crucified. The great city, which of course shows up at the end of 16, the foundation of the great city was broken into three parts.
See, Sodom is, the reason Sodom is mentioned is because God sent two witnesses
mm.
to Sodom to see if the people were behaving the way he heard.
And in Egypt, you got Moses and Aaron.
Because in the Old Testament, no one could be put to death or no one could die unless two witnesses agreed that they deserved to die. And so God sent these two witnesses and
an investigation.
He got gang raped.
Yeah.
And killed. So that's why Sodom is here. That's when Jesus was first crucified. When his two witnesses were treated that way. And that's not the first time probably, but it's the first time scripturally.
Yeah. And then Egypt had two witnesses, which is Moses and Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
Who executed the plagues.
And because the Israelites were worked harder, were more unjustly treated, things got worse instead of better. And Pharaoh was stubborn and refused to let them go. He crucified Christ.
Now I got to back up here. Sodom, the two witnesses that went to Sodom match the fire proceeding from their mouth and devours their enemies. Because that's how Sodom was killed, right?
Yeah.
Then Egypt is more about the plagues.
And Egypt ties to Babylon, even though it's Egypt, because the plague of blood is there in Babylon, in the plagues of Babylon. By the way, I have a very different view of what Babylon is in John.
Yeah, Old Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be the Lord part, where the Lord was crucified.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one other thought, which may tie in or not, Egypt can represent the paganism, right? Where you still mm-hmm. see pagan systems and the occult and the connection back to...
Well, and that's, you see, it was that paganism that infiltrated Christianity. Is that what you were about to say?
Yes. There's got to be some ties when they say Sodom, and you go, well, that's a terrible place, you know, and then Egypt, which, you know, and then it's tied to Jerusalem, which could be confusing until you go, oh, yeah, what's those pagan ideas that affected the religious leaders and civic powers to kill Jesus? You know, there was a very paganistic view.
And it wouldn't be Egyptian, though, because Egypt never believed in an angry God. And never believed in a punitive God. They believed in a courtroom justice where that every heart was weighed against the feather of Mott.
Right.
But they did not believe like Babylon, which had, I mean, you read the Numa Elish and you have all the points of forensic atonement.
Whoa.
I was wondering where the concept better that one man should perish than a whole nation.
Ellen White in Desire of Ages says that he borrowed it from heathen religions. in the mouth of, she talks about how that was a true statement in how John uses it. But in the mouth of Caiaphas, she said that truth was turned into a lie. That in the pagan religions, there was this consciousness that someday someone would die for the nation, and so they offered their children as child sacrifices. Well, I think that Caiaphas borrowed it from the substitute king ritual in Assyria and Babylonia.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
When we get to Babylon, you're going to hear a lot about this. I hope I don't drown you in it.
Even Plato said that if a perfect man were ever to come to this world, we would have to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for that reason, you can argue that Egypt may have spawned that. There is archaeological evidence that in the early days of Egypt, they did child sacrifices or human sacrifices. It's just by the time Babylon comes, by the time Egypt reaches a mature level, that has died out.
You know, Egypt was really a very almost seamless amalgamation between religion and politics, whereas Babylon, the religion was pretty much with the priest. And the politics was more secular. I mean, they were certainly controlling each other. But in Egypt, like the Pharaoh's like, I am God.
Yeah. And Pharaoh was considered to be God. The thing with Babylon is that in the early years of Sumerian culture, this was before Babylon became known, as far as we know. In those years, the temple and the palace were on opposite ends of the town. They were kept separate.
Mm-hmm.
And the earliest king was a priest king, so you began to have the uniting.
Yeah.
But when it really becomes that is when power took over. And everything, economics, kingship, and law became fully established and fully adhered to. Then you have a complete union of church and state, or religion and state. This is not a theocracy. Egypt was a theocracy. It was a true theocracy.
Yeah.
But Babylon was never... Babylon tried to become a theocracy at times. Certain kings deified themselves. But for the most part, Babylon just practiced the union of church and state. And that's what's pictured in Revelation 18. Babylon fornicated with kings. Babylon is a religion. More, it's a city, but it's a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the opposite of the New Jerusalem.
So if the prostitute has daughters, is that the offspring of the fornication with the kings?
I would think so.
So what would those daughters be? You know, it just mentions her daughters, and Adventists have always said, oh, that's the apostate Protestant churches, but that doesn't come from
amalgamation
with kings.
However, it still works in terms of what's happening.
Sure, it does. You know, I'm not saying that isn't part of that, but I wonder if there's more to it than what we've said.
There's no way that Babylon can be Roman Catholicism. Because Roman Catholicism is the beast, and Babylon rides the beast. Babylon is not the beast. Unless you turn the beast into the Roman Empire, and Babylon rides the Roman Empire, then that makes perfect sense. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
It's just there's some evidence in Revelation for Babylon to be old Jerusalem, who rode the beast to crucify Jesus. I haven't gotten that evidence together yet, but every once in a while I see it.
Mm.
You know what? It is nearly 5:30.
How far did we get, guys?
Let's see, 6 verses where I thought we left off last time.
Sometimes I think I have it figured out, and then we talk and I go, man, I need to think this through a lot more.
All right. Let's have prayer. Father, we thank you for leading us today, for helping us to appreciate more fully how judgment and the great controversy and truth about you all fits together. We ask that you will continue to guide us as we continue to study this book. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen.